I have a marvelous mother and father. They had a good marriage. It was an excellent marriage, not just a good marriage, but it was a good marriage without God. And they really made it work. And so I grew up in a home situation watching a marriage that was good, healthy, loving, giving, but with all of that, primarily selfish, I guess. And the family was the family, the God, the pivotal point, and the be-all and end-all. When I set off at the age of 18 to be educated, or to finish my education, or as we say in England, to be finished, one way and another, I was sent to Cambridge. And I went there because my father could afford to send me there, not because I deserved to go. I went to what we call a public school, and each year one girl, two girls were chosen from this school, and I was the only one that applied, so I guess that's how I got to Cambridge. They had to take me. And it's all this snob value stuff in England. You don't earn your place. Some people have to earn their place, but if you're born into a wealthy family and a upper class family, as I was, then you can go where you want, as long as your father's money is there behind you. And so when I got to Cambridge, I found another attitude around, and the attitude here was, why get married at all? Even sort of the insidious student idea that a relationship is what matters, not the piece of paper. And this, of course, was years and hundreds of years ago when I was at college. But even then, I was met with a new concept. And, of course, swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. I'd never been to church. I'd never heard the Christian gospel. I'd never read the Bible. And so when you don't have any morality base, or when you don't have anything except be good and you'll be happy, be bad and you'll be sad, then you imbibe everything else that's around you. And so in a very short time, I thought, well, yes, this is right. Mum and Dad might have been one generation. And anyway, they told me to be good and I'd be happy, and to be bad and I'd be sad. And when I'm good, I'm miserable. And when I'm bad, I'm thrilled to bits. So maybe they had the wrong idea. And I threw it all overboard. And I decided that if I was going to have a relationship with a man, then it would not be on the basis of a piece of paper. Well, I fell sick, and within a very short time I was in hospital, very seriously ill. And it was here that I began to search and seek for God. I forgot all about guys, and I forgot all about marriage. I was fighting for my physical survival, and at the age of 18 came to the realization that there was something my daddy's money couldn't do for me. It couldn't cure me. It was a shock. My daddy's money could not keep me alive. That was another shock. In fact, all the things I've been able to do for myself up to that point, I ceased to be able to do. And I guess when you've fulfilled all your goals at the age of 18, which I had, which show you how low my goals were to have fulfilled them at the age of 18, and you suddenly arrive and realize that you're not even going to get the chance to get married and find out which way is right, it's a shock. And it was from this shock that I began to search for God. And in God's grace, he led a little girl, or he put a little girl in the next bed to me that was a committed Christian. She knew Jesus Christ in a way that I had never deemed possible for a human being to know anybody. She was vibrant. She was pretty. All the things I didn't believe a Christian could be. She was brave. She talked to me about a God who was real to her. And I chewed her up, good and proper, made fun of her, laughed at her, scoffed at her, invited the rest of the ward to join in my blasphemy. But I watched her, and I saw a quality of life that made me homesick. And so she told me about Jesus. And she told me that there was a God who became a baby and died and rose again. And I had never heard the Christian gospel, even though I was at Cambridge University, at the age of 18, in so-called Christian England. And the first time I heard it, I grabbed it, both hands. And even though I'd had the ability and the wherewithal to do everything that I had wanted, not needed, but wanted to do in a short 18 years of good things and bad things, I found that it was all nothing compared to this relationship with a God who was real. And he turned me inside out. He forgave my sin, and there was a lot to forgive. And I love him much because he forgave me much. And he made me better. In 3 days, I was out of hospital, which was an absolute miracle, seeing the little girl next to me had died of the same disease that I had, kidney disease. And I was well. And I went back to find out if what had happened to me in hospital was all an emotional, psychological situation, or whether it was real. And I've had 20 years, I guess, to find out that it was real. 20 years to prove it. And the whole of my thinking was reordered about everything, not just about my behavior and about my work. I was about to be sent away from Cambridge in disgrace. My work took a turn. My life took a turn. My friendships took a turn. My attitudes took a turn. But the whole of my thinking about marriage took a turn, too. And I decided that if I ever did get married, it was going to be a man who loved the Lord Jesus. And it was going to be a man who served God. And if it wasn't going to be a man like that, I wasn't going to get married. I was excited about the God of the Bible, the author that I'd come to know, that opened this book and made it real. And I guess he was all I needed. And we began some very exciting career together there at Cambridge University. Now, what I'm going to say from now on isn't because I'm a pastor's wife, and it isn't because I was a missionary wife, and it isn't because it's the thing I've been told to say. The thing I'm going to say from now on is because I know it's true. And I know what Jesus Christ has meant, not only in my personal life, but in my marriage. And if I wasn't a pastor's wife, I'd be saying it to you. And if I wasn't a missionary wife, I'd be saying it to you. In fact, if I was still a banker's wife, which I was at one time, I would be saying exactly the same thing. Now, what have I got to say? Well, I've got to say a lot. And I want to take what I've got to say from Isaiah. Or you would say Isaiah. It's Isaiah. Chapter 9, verse 6. And I want to tell you the difference that Jesus Christ has made in my life and my marriage, our marriage. The promise is given here that Jesus, this child, will be born and given to us. Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. And his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, and the Prince of Peace. And our marriage is as good as it is, and it is good. Not because anything of ourselves has achieved what is and has been achieved, but because of who he is. Well, who is he? What you need in a marriage, you need somebody that's wonderful. You need somebody who's a counselor. You need somebody who's a mighty God. You need somebody who's an everlasting father. And you need somebody who's a prince of peace. And you need somebody like that governing your marriage. The government has got to be upon his shoulder. And if the government is not upon his shoulder, there will be no increase of his kingdom. And the qualities of his kingdom, quite simply, as we see in verse 7, are order, establishment or stability, justice, rightness. Those are the qualities of the kingdom that the king will bring when he governs our marriage. Now, essentially, I want to talk around that. First of all, the government would be upon his shoulder. Even as a young Christian, I realized to know Jesus as Savior was not going to make the Christian life work. It's when you know him as King and Lord, it begins to make sense. And a lot of us take Jesus for what we can get out of him. Like the heavenly garbage collector. Sure, he's fine to forgive my sins, but don't let him rule my life. And of course, the Christian life isn't going to work if we take him for what we can get out of him. It's only going to work when he takes what he can get out of us. We emphasize, he is mine, the need meter in the sky, instead of realizing he's Lord, he's King, and I'd better shape up. Now, when I've got a Lord or a King, upon whose shoulders is the government of my personal life, that has to affect my marriage. And when you've got two people who have decided that the government, the lordship of his life will be the keynote of their personal philosophy, then you've got a marriage that's going to work. In England, we have some weird ideas and traditions, and one of them is the crowning of the queen or the king. And what happens is all these people come and kneel before her and they say something like, my lord and my liege. and it's all very beautiful and all very traditional, and everybody oohs and ahs and thinks it's great. And it is great. From the day the Queen of England was crowned until now, she has never issued an order. She has never given an edict. She just sits on her throne and that's it. She's the figurehead. Somebody else does all that, the Prime Minister. He's the one that does it. And you know what I find in a lot of Christians' lives? I find that they say my Lord and my liege on a Sunday morning. Or if anybody asked them if they were a Christian, sure, I acknowledge him as king. But the Prime Minister gives the orders. That's you. And you know, when it's like that, the government isn't on his shoulders, the government's on yours. You're carrying it all. And I want to tell you something, where marriage is concerned, your shoulders aren't broad enough. And if you're still at the point where you think they are, even if your marriage has been great up to now, there will come a point when it will not be enough. Not in this day and age. Not when your kids are growing up. Not when you've got three teenagers, like we have. The government on our shoulders would not be enough for that. So you've got to decide he's going to govern. Now, there's a beautiful little story, and I want to turn it to you, in John's Gospel, chapter 2, just to give you an illustration of what I'm talking about here. John, chapter 2. It's the marriage in Cana of Galilee. The mother of Jesus was there. Both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. When they lacked wine, the mother of Jesus said, "They've got no wine." And Jesus said, "Woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Whatsoever he saith unto you, do it." You know the story, and they drew it out, and it was better than any they'd had before. Not long ago, well, it was long ago, it was 4 years ago, I got an invitation through Bob Nelson to go and talk to a bunch of ladies. And I said, yes, yes, I'll do it. It was on a Sunday night. I looked at the bit of paper. I didn't even ask Bob what it was, which now knowing Bob, I should have done. Anyway, I didn't. And I trotted along to this address and to my surprise found myself at a bowling alley. This was Sunday night at 9 o'clock, and I thought, well, that's rather strange. Maybe I've got the wrong place. Anyway, I went inside, very disheveled. It had been snowing. My car had got stuck in the ditch on the way. I had a hairpiece on which had blown off in the wind as I shoveled my car off, and I'd stuck it on my head again. Walked in this place and said, is there a bunch of women here that are waiting for a speaker? And they said, well, there's a whole lot of women in that back room. The guys are in a meeting. Maybe that's them. And I walked in, and it was a wine tasting. So I really looked just the job. I had my hair on one side. And I thought, well, I really am at the right place. Well, I sat there. They were on their 15th taste of wine at that point, so they weren't really noticing who'd came in and who went out. And at the end of it, a gentleman got up, and he'd been running this wine tasting thing, and he said, now then, we've got somebody come to speak to us. And I don't really know anything about her. I think her name's Jill Briscoe something. Oh, I think she's got a comedy act, he said. Now, you can imagine this situation. Here I was, saying, oh, God, they really do look ready to listen to a religious talk, you know. They're really going to be surprised. What on earth am I going to say to them? And as I walked up to shake hands with this man, he had a bottle of wine in his hand, and there was about that much left in the bottom of it. And as I put out my hand to shake his hand, he put the wine bottle into it. And here I stood on a Sunday night, thinking, I hope nobody's here from church. The pastor's wife looking as if she'd thoroughly enjoyed the wine tasting herself, and God gave me some, I believe, inspired words, and I said, oh dear, just look at this, the wine's run out. What a shame. So that happened once before, a place called Cana in Israel, and the wine ran out because there was a wedding where Jesus was not the governor, he was only the guest. And the whole thing went flat and dreary, just like it has for some of you ladies. You got married. You invited Jesus. You wanted him there, perhaps, for superstition, add a bit of religion, because you wanted a church wedding. He was there, but he was just on the same level as all the rest of the people. And it wasn't until Jesus Christ became the governor that he turned the water into wine. Now, I took an hour to say it, and I went on, but that's essentially what I said. And you know, that's just about it. If Jesus was invited to your wedding, just as a guest, then there will be a point when the wine will run out. Now, there won't be no wine there. Listen to what I'm saying. There'll have been plenty of wine, but there'll be a point when it'll run out. Because it takes the quality of the dynamic Holy Spirit in your life to keep your wedding what He intended it to be. You see, marriage is a divine institution. And that sounds an awful word. We think of bars and gates and warders when we think of institutions, and we say, yeah, that's like my marriage. I don't like that name. But an institution is really for the good and the benefit of the people that thought it up for them. And God thought of marriage not as an institution in the bad sense that we think of it, but as a good thing. His idea was in the heart of God. And it all depends if Jesus isn't just alongside the whole of the people in your marriage and your life as one of the guests that you are polite to on a Sunday. The thing is, if He's the governor, if He's really the governor of your marriage. Now, I wonder what's governing your marriage. Mutual convenience can govern a marriage. Sex can govern a marriage. Kids can govern a marriage. Habit, keeping up the act, can govern a marriage. Money can govern a marriage. In-laws can govern a marriage. I don't know what's governing your marriage, but I know one thing. If any of those things are not Christ, the wine will run out. Now, what does it mean when I say He's going to govern a marriage? I mean, He's a spirit and He's spiritual. What does it mean practically? Well, when the wine ran out, the servant said to Mary, "The wine's run out." And she said, "Whatsoever He saith unto you, do it." That's what it means for Christ to govern a marriage. Whatsoever He says to us, we've got to do it. And guys, you've got to find out what He says so you know what you're supposed to be doing and what she's supposed to be doing. That's your job. How do I know where to look? How do I know where to start to find out what I'm supposed to be doing so I can do it, so He can be the governor of my marriage and turn the water into wine? Well, you do know, have to know where to look. It's all relevant. Absolutely all of it is relevant. But there are some passages that are more relevant than others. For example, and we'll just look at it quickly, the famous passage in Ephesians. Just turn to Ephesians 5 quite quickly with me for a minute. Here's a passage that's all for you. It's all about the man's responsibility. Ephesians 5:22 onwards tells us some of the things, the instructions that you're supposed to be doing. What are they? Well, if a man wants to find out how to treat his wife, here are some of the instructions. Christ is the head of the man. You are supposed to be the head of the authority on all the big decisions and policy making of the woman. Marriage is a partnership, we know that. You're supposed to have fellowship in your partnership, and I guess the definition of fellowship is two fellows in a ship. You're in it together. But the thing about it, when Christ is the governor, is there are three of you in the ship. There are three of you in the ship. And you both ask Him about the things that are problems in your marriage. And as you both ask Him, you usually come to the same conclusion. So there's never a fight. And there's never the big, I'm the boss and you're the servant or the slave, this sort of feeling. There is a partnership, a finding out from the governor what he's telling you each to do. And of course, he's not going to tell you both to do something different. And that's the way it works. I can only think on two occasions in the whole of our 20 years of marriage when Stuart has disagreed or told me no, because we've always come to the same conclusions. One time he was right and one he was wrong. But as Christ is the head, so you are the head of the wife. Then it says that you have to love your wife. The wife is never told to love her husband. It's interesting. She's told to respond to her husband. Submit means to respond. You're told to love your wife, which will bring a response. So the initiative is yours. And you're commanded to love. Now, generally speaking, you're commanded to love. In John 14, it says, love. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Now, if God commands you to do something, it's obeyable. And that takes it out of the realm of emotion into the realm of decision. And that helps. Because when there's no reason to love her, you can say, I will love. And love, a definition of agape love, is being primarily interested in the other's well-being. You can at least be interested. That's where you can start. when you can't feel the emotion of love, which is nothing to do with love, as the Bible talks about it, then you can be interested. You can start somewhere. You can find something that you can be interested in and start there. And so it says that you are to be the head, you are to love your wife, you are to give yourself to your wife as Christ gave himself for the church. The anomaly is what Christ did for the church, you are supposed to do for your wife. Saving, preserving, protecting. Not a possessive thing, but as you give yourself to her, then she will be secure in your love. I guess one of the things women fear more than anything else is they need to know they're secure in your love, that they can trust you. Absolutely. Out of sight. They can trust you. I thank God that I've been able to do that with Stuart. And that hasn't always been an easy thing to do with him away 10 months of 10 years of our life. I could trust him. I was safe and secure in the knowledge that he was trustworthy. And that was because he had made it abundantly clear to me that he had given himself to me. It says that you are to sanctify the wife, set her apart for your own use, sole use. Let her know that as far as she's concerned, there's nobody else in the world. She's all there is. And often the wife's behavior that starts to be very erratic and neurotic is often because she is not quite sure of you. And that is the worst possible thing. I cannot imagine, because I've never been through it, what that must be like. I would rather lose my husband than not be sure of him. Then it says that you're to nourish her as Christ did the church. What does that mean? It means to find her gifts and make sure she exercises them. Does she have a fantastic gift for washing dishes? I'm sure she can do it. But as a person, what is her gift? Is she exercising the thing that she's best at, as well as the duties she has to do? How well do you know her? And so here's some of your instructions. Now, of course, our instructions are there too. There's just 3 instructions in a passage where there's about 10 to you and 3 to us. And our instructions are to respond to you as you do all those things to us. And you know, it's easy to submit to a man like that. And it's easy to respond to a man who is giving and loving as Christ gave and loved the church. And so when he says, whatsoever I say unto you, do it, find out what he told you to do and do it. Obey it. Say, I will begin to act in the way the Bible tells me to act towards my wife. And as you begin, perhaps even without the feelings, which have nothing to do with it, the feelings will follow. It's a bit like praying. There you are in bed in the morning and you don't want to get up and hit the Bible and meet with the Lord. And you never will if you wait till you feel like it. You have to take will by the hand, and you and will have to go and pray. Every day, for months. One day, one emotion will say to the other, you know, we're not going to stop them, let's go along as well. And it's the same with your wife. I will love her. I will begin to act as if I loved her when I don't feel I love her. And as you obey, the water will be turned into wine, and it'll be better than any you've had before. Now then, for all this, we need who he is. Who is he? Let's remind ourselves, he is wonderful. And the word wonderful means he has an inconceivable method of assisting us. And that's what I'm going to need. If I'm going to need to do this for my wife, and if she's going to need to do what she has to do for me, I've got to have a source of power that has an inconceivable method of assisting me. And Jesus said to a guy that asked his name, who was called Manoah in the book of Judges, he said, Manoah, do you want to know who I am? And Manoah said, yes, what's your name? And God said, my name is wonderful. Great. I have an inconceivable way of assisting you to do what I've asked you to do. You know, 2 of the things he's asked us to do that we need an inconceivable amount of power to do are in the book of Ephesians. I didn't read them. It says, for this cause, marriage, verse 31, shall a man leave his father and mother and shall be joined unto his wife. Leave and cleave. The 2 things that are something he tells us to do if our marriage is going to work are to leave and to cleave. And for that, I need somebody that's wonderful to assist me. What do we mean by leave? I mean leave.
your parents. That's what it says in Genesis. For this cause shall a man leave his mother and father. One of the reasons for divorce is the interference of in-laws. They've never let go. I know of couples whose in-laws insist on going on every vacation with them. And they let them. And there is no way that is not going to cause trouble. It's bad enough having them to dinner, isn't it, sometimes? Now, some of you are in-laws, and you're looking at it from the other point of view. And some of us have had a terrific struggle to let go. And it's very easy for me to tell parents to let go. I haven't got any of mine. I'm going to be the lousiest mother-in-law of the lot. I know that. I'm sensing it even now as my children begin to date. I'm going to be a terrible mother-in-law. And I need somebody wonderful to be an inconceivable help to me because I'm a possessive mother. But of course I have someone, for unto me a child is born and the government is on his shoulders. And he's wonderful. And he's going to help me to do that. We have to leave and we have to cleave. And the cleaving in this sense is talking about not just sexually, but emotionally and spiritually. We have to use our bodies to bless and to give instead of to get. We have to get rid of wrong notions in our minds that we learned in school instead of from a right source and that are with us all our lives. We have to communicate. We have to stop expecting our husbands, just as you have to stop expecting your wife to have ESP and know what you're thinking, and we have to say it and tell each other and open up. And emotionally and spiritually, we have to cleave, commit ourselves, get involved in the innermost person that we have married. Now, for that, we need somebody that's wonderful to help us, somebody who has inconceivable ways of helping us. And we have him in our marriage if he is the governor. What else do we need in our marriage? We need a counselor. And I'm so glad that the government's on his shoulders and he's our counselor, because we've needed a counselor. Stuart and I have needed a marriage counselor. And we have one. His name is Jesus. Wonderful counselor. Why do people need marriage counselors? To help them to understand the other person. To have a third person so you can go and sit there, even if you're so hostile to your mate, that all you can do is to look at the counselor and tell him what you feel about the other person. That's a frightening thing. We do too much of this. But to sit in one of those situations, it always makes me physically sick sometimes. And I see somebody that hates so much, they cannot even look at that person. But to have a counselor there, they can talk to that person without even looking them and let it out and have it out. And then the counselor can listen to the other person and make them listen. And then they can begin. Now that's what a counselor is needed for. And usually they're needed because the person is incompatible. Get many, many phone calls in a week. Is the pastor in? I say no, because he never is. And they say, we want a divorce. And I say, well, we don't do divorces. And so then the little voice says, but you don't understand. And I say, well, I think I do, but what's the trouble? And they say, we're incompatible. And I say, oh, didn't you know that's the reason for marriage, not the reason for divorce? I said, did you marry somebody that's totally opposite to you? And they say, how did you know? You don't even know my name. I say, well, it's easy. Opposites attract. Most of us do that. It's very seldom we marry somebody that's the same as ourselves. And it's the very thing that attracts us why we married the girl. And then as soon as you're married, the very thing that attracted you becomes the irritant. Not funny. You live with it a bit. Now, the strange thing is, God had this neat idea of filling up that which was lacking in the other. When he looked at poor old Adam all alone, he said, it isn't good. It's not good. It's not good for that guy to be alone. He needs somebody to help meet his needs. There were parts of his personality that needed a help meet, a counterpart, that had to be opposite. Now, the frightening thing is that 99% of all divorces are obtained on the grounds of incompatibility. Whereas, as far as I can see, the Bible says that's the reason for marriage. And if you can learn to adapt and respond and give and move and grow on a one-to-one in marriage, you'll learn to do it outside the society that is the home. And we'll begin to see a world that lives at peace instead of in hostility. And so you see, it's very important that if you profess to be a believer, your marriage works so that the world can see a society within a society that is using the counselor to obtain a compatibility that is wonderful, out of sight, and isn't happening without Jesus. I think of one area that we've needed a counselor. That's the money side of our marriage. Now, we didn't have any money for 10 years when we were missionaries, so it was easy. We didn't fight about it. I never kept books. I tried for 2 weeks, but Stuart was a bank inspector. And I stopped math when I was 16 because they just couldn't stand to teach me anymore. And so that's what it's like. When I go to Cole's supermarket, I hold 20 people up while I do my sums on the register. And I never have been able to learn. I've tried, and I've never been able to learn. I have a blank where money is concerned. Now, what do you do when you're married to a bank inspector who looks at everything and his eye goes straight to the mistake because it's trained to do so? I remember trying to keep a book. I didn't know how to do it. And he came home and he said, "What is this?" And at the bottom, instead of balance, I'd put left to spend. So my new bank inspector husband looked at me and he said, "Well, where is it?" And I said, "I've spent it." So that's how incompatible we are, just in one little aspect. Just one little aspect. What do you do with something like that? I've got a counselor. And I tell you, if I couldn't go in prayer to my counselor and tell him what I think of my husband, I don't know what would have happened. I would have saved it up. Does your wife really know how to pray? I don't mean say little prayers, it's a shopping list to God. I mean, does she know what it is to get on her knees and say, "God, that guy of mine is being this and that and the other," and have God counsel her? So you get up a few knees saying, "Well, I got to do some moving here. That bit's my fault. I'm going to try again." Changed! Now, this is powerful stuff. It's not saying a little prayer like a lucky charm. Prayer is the debating chamber of the soul. Prayer is where you go and say, "God, I've got a problem in my marriage." And he'd say, "Yes, you have. And I'm the mighty counselor. I'm wonderful. And there are words I will tell you, and whatsoever I say unto you, you're going to do it with the power that I will give you, and we will work it out." Now, when both of you have a counselor like that, for unto you a child is offered and given, it's going to be all right, whatever the problem, and however deep-seated it is. What else do we have? Well, he's a wonderful... He's a counselor, he's a mighty God, and the word means the I am. He is all that you need for every occasion. All that you need for every occasion. The word means strength. Strength. So that it's even possible to do without your husband. And I've been a single parent for 10 years. That's hard. Your wife is a single parent most of the day. And she struggles with that. And so when you come home at night, she overloads on you, and all you want to do is overload what you've been out fighting all day. But you know something? When you've got a wonderful counselor and a mighty God, a power in your life, he will enable your wife to be a single parent, to be father and mother all day until you come back and she can share that a little bit. And if she's expecting from you what only God can give her, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. But I believe it's possible, because I know I've had to prove it, that it's possible to be a single parent and not to expect my man to do things I can well save him from doing and leave him to do the things I really need him to do. And I guess that's what 10 years without Stuart did for me. It helped me grow up. And maybe what you need to say to your wife, some of you, is grow up in the right way. You need to say that to her. Do you know what you need to do, honey? You can say to her, "You need to get to know Jesus Christ in such a way that you draw from him your strength and your patience and all the things you're going to need that I would supply if I'm here, but I can't because I'm at work." And then she'd stop blaming you for not producing what only God can produce in her. It's very easy to rely on your husband, to make him your Holy Spirit, especially when you know he's supposed to be the authority. Stuart is not my Holy Spirit. He is not my God. I am a bigamist. I am married to two men, a heavenly husband and an earthly husband. In fact, Romans 5 tells me I'm married to another, even to Jesus. And which is the most important? Obviously, my heavenly husband, who enables me to be to my earthly husband what he tells me to be, but enables me to be, through my relationship and union spiritually with him, what I need to be without my husband. And that's such a relief. And I know some of you men have got wives that have taken off, maybe come here to Bible study and got all religious and you don't know what's happened. You suddenly find yourself married to a girl you didn't marry. That's a shock. Maybe you wouldn't have even married her. Maybe you don't like her much like this. Just encourage her. Just share. And if she's gone a bit wild, she'll come back. When I found Christ, I went so wild I was asked to leave college again, this time for being good instead of bad. And you know, this is what happens. You just come into this terrific relationship with this heavenly husband, and it's just like getting married all over again, and you want to talk about it, and you say the wrong things, and you do it the wrong way. Just be patient. And realize that in that relationship she's trying to grow in lies the great thing that can happen to your marriage, and don't be jealous of it. I've talked to some of you men who are jealous of the relationship their wife has with Jesus Christ. It's an incredible thing. In that relationship, perhaps lies the wine of your marriage. In fact, I know it does. And it can be better than any you've had before. So we have a mighty God, we have a Father of eternity, the stability that we need in a marriage. The order of the kingdom. Do you know the thing that's helped me? One of the things about women is they're always up and down. Have you noticed that? You know, John the Baptist said, when the king comes, he's going to fill up the valleys, he's going to level the mountains, he's going to make the crooked places straight, and he's going to make the rough places smooth. And I know in my own personal life, the valleys of depression, just as a woman, because I'm a woman, that I go through, have been filled up by the child that was given to me and the son that was born. And they've been filled up, as Isaiah 61 tells me, how? Whatsoever he says unto you, do it. He says, I will give you the garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness. Does your wife suffer from depression? From a real spirit of heaviness? Now, instead of deciding she's no need to, and maybe she hasn't, why not, as the head of the house, try to grow so much in the Lord Jesus that you help her to grow so she knows what it is to put on in the morning a garment of praise instead of that garment of heaviness? What does she dress in the morning? A spirit of heaviness? Well, I know what that spirit of heaviness is. I've lived under it. Just this last year, I've woken up with it and I've gone to bed with it in one aspect of a problem that we've had. And you know what I found? I found as I have put on deliberately this garment of praise, as I've said, I will find something to thank God for in this. I refuse to dress myself in that spirit of heaviness. As I have done what he's told me to do with the power available to me to obey his commands, then the valley has been filled up. And then the mountains are leveled. The characteristics of his kingdom, justice and righteousness. He will not allow pride to stay in my life. He will help me to say I'm sorry to my husband. There's only one person helps me to say sorry to my husband. That's Jesus. I don't like saying sorry to anybody. That's the hardest thing to do, and I guess women find it a little easier than men do. But you know what he says? He said, every mountain will be leveled if the king is the governor, if the government's on his shoulder. And he will help you to say sorry. And so I need a father of eternity. I need the stability of the kingdom in my life. And lastly, I need a prince of peace. He is the author of conditions that involve everlasting and broken peace. The absence of war. The absence of war. I need a prince of peace in my marriage. Is that what you need today? Some of you guys need a prince of peace. Is there an unbelievable hostile situation developing in your marriage? And it's just as if it's a nightmare. It's getting worse and worse every day. And it's going to be a war. War's going to break out in some of your homes. Maybe it has already. Now then, unto us a child is given, unto us a son is born, so that he can be the author of conditions that involve everlasting and broken peace. He can make it work. And I know this to be true. To tell you the truth, I love a war. I'm that sort of person. I like a fight. I'm a competitor. Always have been. And so is Stuart. So in that way, we're the same. We both enjoy a fight. But I can honestly never remember having one. Never once in our marriage. I mean that. I can remember other things that I have had. I wouldn't tell you. But on this area, because both of us have recognized the government is on his shoulder, and of the increase of his government means the increase of his peace. That's what it says in Isaiah. Of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end. When he increases the governorship of my life, when I love Jesus with all I've got, when he's king of my life and king of my marriage, king of my motherhood, king of my loverhood, king of everything, then of the increase of his peace, there shall be no end. It gets better and better and better, and he turns the water into wine every time. And God hasn't given us a marriage that's even like my mum and dad's marriage, which was the best marriage I ever saw without God. God has given us an eternal triangle in the right sense, and the presence of the child that was born and the son that was given in our marriage has given it the zip of the wine, the exhilaration, the sparkle, the warmth. And over again, he's turned the water into wine for us. Even when we were apart, even when we're together. Now, I want to ask you guys a very relevant question. Do you need a wonderful counselor, a mighty God, an everlasting Father, a Prince of Peace, in your marriage? And if you don't, could you honestly say, I think we might, as I look down the road of the future? Maybe you've never even met him. Maybe you're like me. And you need to initially come and say, I need to know the King. Let me ask Jesus into my life. And some of you need to have the level of your pride leveled right now, because some of you are saying, I'd never admit that. Or maybe you do know Jesus, but he's not the governor, and the government is certainly not on his shoulders personally or in your marriage, and you need to put it there. Do you know where that picture comes from? In the Old Testament, they took a key and they laid it on the high priest's shoulder as a symbol of putting the governing of God on the high priest for the nation. And that's what you need to do. You need to take the key to your life and to your marriage, and you need to deliberately make a decision, and you need to say, I'm going to put it on his shoulders, because they're broad enough and they're big enough and they're great enough for all the problem that I have.